Richard Gere was really great in this.
This is Breathless.
I'll go back every few years to be like, okay, how do I, like, reassess how I feel. I do the same thing with In-N-Out because I don't really like In-N-Out.
What?
Every couple years, I'm like, okay, let me see if I still don't really like In-N-Out. And then I'll try it. Like, yeah, I don't really like it anymore.
So where do you go for a burger?
Oh, plenty of places. In L.A.?
Yeah.
I love Apple Pan.
Yeah, Apple Pan is good. This one, and I like Pie and Burger more.
Oh, I really like Pie. They're pretty comparable. Yeah. I like Pie and Burger. I was so happy when I moved here and discovered that place, because my all-time favorite burger place is in the Bay Area in Hayward. It's called Val's Burgers, and it's just a no-nonsense. It's been there since like the 50s, and it's stuck in time. Mm-hmm. It's a no-nonsense charbroiled burger, and the burger is just really juicy, and it's just like ketchup, lettuce, tomatoes, pickles. That's it. Mm-hmm. But like, the burger is just so good. Mm. And that's like my favorite kind. Like, if you have to put a bunch of stuff on it, it's like sushi. Like, if you have to put a bunch of stuff on it, that means the fish or the beef, it's not great.
Yeah.
So that's my favorite. Val's Burgers in Hayward. Love that place. And again, weird. Like, they're closed on Sundays and Mondays, and they have like weird hours. It's also like a milkshake bar.
Yum.
Best milkshakes I've ever had. Best malts. I always get everything malted. So good.
Yum.
You have, if you're up there, Val's Burgers.
Okay.
Holy cow. That's my favorite burger in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. Hello. You are listening to Seen and Heard. I'm Greg. I'm joined by my co-host, Jackie. And we're back this week to discuss a certain film, a certain seminal film. As Criterion describes it, there was before Breathless and there was after Breathless. So yes, we are doing Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless from 1960. Yes, 1960.
It's number 13 on Sight and Sound's Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time, and that's what we do on this podcast. We watch movies on that list.
I know Jackie is very excited to talk about this week's movie.
I'm excited and nervous.
This kind of feels like a personal Prince episode for you.
But not really. I love this movie as much as the next movie lover. I love this movie. But like,
wow, you do?
I don't know. Let's save it. Let's save it for the episode.
So we're doing Breathless, but outside of Breathless, Jackie, and besides going to the smokehouse, having a delightful evening with our significant others, what have you been watching the last week?
Not that much. I've been super busy and it's been sucky. The only three things that are popping out to me, I watched Defending Your Life, which I liked.
I love Defending. No. I like it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Some people really love it. And I struggled to see what was like really extraordinary about it. But I did like it. It was a good time. It's just like, I feel it should have gone a little deeper. It had the opportunity and it just chose not to. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does.
But it was funny and it was...
You should see Fun. Modern Romance.
I will.
That one's my favorite.
Albert Brooks.
Yeah. So our mutual friend James, Defending Your Life is like his basically like one of his all time favorite movies.
Really?
We both love Albert Brooks and bonded over that in his movie, because I had not seen Defending Your Life, and the whole time when I met him, he's like, "Oh, you got to see Defending Your Life." And I saw it, and it's good. It's more good stuff. But yeah, I like Lost in America more. I like Modern Romance more. Modern Romance is like one of my all time favorites. It's hilarious. You'll like it. Yeah.
Winter Light.
Oh, sure. The Bergman movie. Mm-hmm. I was thinking Winter's Bone in my head. I was like, wait, the one with...
I have seen that.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
But I watched Winter Light.
Winter Light?
It's called Winter Light.
Yeah, Winter Light.
It's part of the Silence of God trilogy by Bergman. And it was incredible.
Oh.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Why doesn't anyone talk about it?
It's one that falls... That's one of my favorite Bergman movies, and that's one that falls through the cracks. Yeah.
Breathtaking.
It's like 80 minutes long.
It's 80 minutes long. It's extremely thought-provoking. It's beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Great performances. It's a near-perfect movie, and no one talks about it.
Agreed.
And it's, 80 minutes long.
Beautiful.
I loved it. It was fantastic.
Yeah. That's one of those movies I could almost watch like anytime.
And then I watched Seven Samurai.
Oh, was that your first time?
Yes.
Really?
And it's Bug's Life.
Well, of course. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And it's Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, that's obvious. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that. But I didn't know it was Bug's Life.
Yeah.
It was great. What can I say about it? Come on.
That's not your first Kurosawa, is it?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a hell of a one to start with.
It was long.
It's long, but doesn't it go by really quick?
No.
Oh. I think it does. Because you get so involved in it.
Yeah. It took me like... I knew when I watched it on Sunday, I was like, okay, this is going to be my day. Watching this 3.5 hour movie.
Yeah.
It was still great, though, obviously.
I love that this is how you spend your weekend, because I do the same thing.
Yeah. What else is there to do?
It's like, that's the highlight of the day. If I can, like, you know, on a nice weekend, just, like, carve out the day to just watch some super long movie. Like, that's heaven.
But I've come to the conclusion, I don't think I'm crazy about super long movies. Like, I'm not opposed to them by any means, but I think it's so much more impressive. Like, and I watched Winter Light right after, and I thought that was so much. And there's all the grandeur of Seven Samurai, right? Which is obviously incredible. But the fact, there's something about making an 80-minute masterpiece,
oh,
which
for
is
sure.
crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't shake away the feeling that when I hear a movie's 4 hours, 3.5 hours, I know that I'm going to at some point be like...
Restless.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think for me, it's just that if a movie's great, if you're thinking of like Seven Samurai or Godfather 2 or something... It just gives you more time to like live in that world.
That's
which is
true.
When the movie's great and it's long, you're yes. just like, oh boy. Like yes. more time spent in this world.
Sound of Music.
Which is not that long. It's like 2.5 hours, right? Maybe
three. Is it really? I thought it was three.
Maybe three, yeah.
Anyway, what have you been watching?
Not that much. I did rewatch Lux Aeterna, the Gaspar Noé movie.
What?
Yeah.
When?
A few days ago. I showed it to Molly because she hadn't seen it.
Did you get the Blu-ray?
Yeah, from the UK, because it's been out over there for like a couple years.
Okay.
So I was waiting to see it because I wanted to see it in the theater, and then I saw it in the theater, and then I got the disc from Mira.
Okay.
So yeah, I watched the Blu-ray, showed it to Molly, gave her a pair of sunglasses to wear for the last like 10 minutes of the movie because there's a strobing effect.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really love it. It's becoming one of my favorite Gaspar Noé movies. I think I kind of like the first time I saw it, because it's only 50 minutes, and the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, I kind of expected it to go, like, a little further.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I, like, sat on it and came back to it, I'm like, no, this is, like, exactly... It ends where it should end. Mm-hmm. And, like, again, it's 50 minutes. It's a beautiful thing. I saw Titane.
Oh, how was it?
It was good. It was good. Molly and I watched... We actually did a double feature. We did Lux Aeterna, and then we did Titane.
Wow!
And we both really love Titane. Yeah. I think... You haven't seen it, right?
No, I've been wanting to.
It's the Palme d'Or winner from last year. And the director had done Raw before, mm-hmm. which I saw and liked. I thought it was pretty good. But I think this one's kind of on another level. Director's name is Julia Ducournau. Probably completely butchering that name. But yeah, really fascinating movie. It's best to go in knowing as little as possible. Because it's just like one of those movies that starts as one thing and turns into something else. But really, really well done.
Nice.
And then, to cap it off, I did see the new Cronenberg movie, Crimes of the Future.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so a group of us went to see it in the theater. And that was fun. That was fun.
Was it?
Now, you know what? I'm kind of in the middle of the road on this one. I gave it 3 stars on Letterboxd. There were some good, proper Cronenberg, shocking body horror stuff in there and some crazy, like, biomechanical, weird contraptions and weird sex stuff.
Yeah.
That was all great, but there were kind of long stretches of just nothing in here. And I found myself...
How long is it?
It's like less than 2 hours. I think it's an hour 45 or something, but... I found myself my mind started wandering at a couple points in the movie because it's so expository. And the movie kind of like, the whole movie, like 90% of the runtime, the movie is just like setting itself up.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of ends. And you're like, okay, well, what was all that exposition for? Mm-hmm. Like, how about, it's a lot, and like a lot of the story itself is kind of boring.
Hmm.
Like the idea of I love the world of the film. I think the actors are great. I think a lot of the ideas are great. Some individual scenes are really great. But at the end of the day, the story itself is kind of bland. It's kind of just this like routine, uninspiring, basic story. And I was like, oh, that's the movie? Like, that's the story? Oh, okay, sure. So kind of lukewarm on it. I would recommend it. Obviously, if you're a Cronenberg fan, I'm sure you've already seen it. It's very provocative. I love all that stuff. But kind of disappointed how run-of-the-mill some of it felt. And like I said, and this rarely happens to me, but my mind started wandering while I was watching the movie. And for a movie that kind of like visceral and shocking.
In your face.
And in your face. Yeah, I was... Yeah.
Strange.
Not one of his best, but not one of his worst. Because I'm kind of like hot and cold on him. Like, there are some Cronenberg movies I hate. And it's funny, we're just talking about Crash. I think this has a lot of Crash in it, but I think Crash is better.
Okay.
But yeah, so lukewarm recommendation.
Okay.
Didn't blow my mind. But yeah.
You think I'll be scared?
No. I don't think you'll be scared.
I don't like gore, though. I really don't.
It's, yeah, but it's not really gore. Are you creeped out by like surgery?
I'm not crazy about it. That's what a lot of the movie is. Watching a knife slice someone open.
Oh, well, that you should still see it, but that's a lot of the movie.
I know.
But yeah, that was sort of my week in film. Just to bring up a little bookkeeping point, so I know the last episode we did pose a listener question about which of the 1930s French films you liked the most. It was between La Talante, Rules of the Game, and A Day in the Country. But we got our schedules confused, and we're actually recording this episode before that one airs. So it's impossible to read your responses if we haven't even posted that episode yet. But anyway, so yeah, if you do want to submit, you can reach us at hello@seenandheardpod.com. You can go on our website, seenandheardpod.com also. or go on Instagram, the Arroyo Film Club, ARROYO Film Club on Instagram. You can DM us there. But if you want to weigh in about those three French films from the 30s, whether you like one the best or which one you hate, or just kind of, you know, if you want to weigh in, we'll read it next time. I promise, next time.
Okay.
Anyway, with that said,
let's get into this week's movie, number 13 on the list, Breathless. Breathless was released in 1960. It was directed by Jean-Luc Godard. Writing credits go to Godard for the screenplay, and scenario by François Truffaut and Claude Chabrol. He was technically the technical advisor. Cinematography by Raoul Cotard. Michel Poirard is a part-time petty thief and a full-time Humphrey Bogart wannabe who steals a car and kills a police officer who chases him down. He then flees to Paris, where he is waiting for some money that he's owed in order to move on to Rome. However, he feels he can't go without Patricia, an American journalist and student that he's been seeing. The couple hang out together in Paris, contemplating life and love, while Patricia goes to work and Michel avoids the police. Finally, Patricia decides she doesn't want to go to Rome with Michel and turns him into the cops. In a half-hearted attempt to run away with his money, Michel is shot down, and Patricia stands next to the police as he utters his final words. It is truly disgusting.
Yep.
The film stars the iconic duo of Jean-Paul Belmondo as Michel and Jean Seberg as Patricia. And this was Jean-Luc Godard's debut film. Like many French New Wave auteurs, he was a critic at the Cahiers du Cinéma. Eventually, he helped some of his peers make their short films. He started writing scripts for the studios. He worked as the Parisian press agent for Fox, which is how he met Georges de Beauregard, who is the producer of Breathless. So he basically gave him a few options of like, okay, for my first feature, I have like these ideas in mind. And he chose Breathless, the producer. And yeah, it opened to commercial theaters. It was an immediate success. It wasn't this small art house thing. It sold like, I think, it was something like over 200,000 tickets in its first 2 weeks or something crazy like that. And it went to the US a year later and it's beloved.
The rest
it always
history.
Has been. Yeah. The film started Godard on his great 60s new wave streak. His political activism eventually caused him to start the Ziga Vertov group with Jean-Pierre Gorin in 1968. Mm. If you guys remember, Ziga Vertov.
Man with the movie camera.
Yeah. And other Godards on the list are Contempt at number 21, Pierrot Le Fou at number 42, and Histoire du Cinéma at 48.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. he also, in 1975, made a film called Numéro 2, which is, according to him, a remake of Breathless, but it has nothing to do with Breathless.
I haven't seen it. Have you?
No.
Yeah. Maybe it's a spiritual sequel.
I haven't seen anything after his like new wave streak. I really haven't seen any of those Ziga Vertov movies.
No. Have you? I have not seen that much Godard at the end of the day. I've seen like 5 movies.
I've only seen like the ones from the 60s
yeah.
until 68.
Oh, I thought you were this huge Godard fan.
Oh, I don't know where you got that from. Oh. You've always said that. That's your guy. That's your guy. Not really. Like any other film lover, uh-huh. loves those movies of his, those 8 years of movies.
Right, right. His 60s run, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's his golden period, yeah.
Definitely.
Before he went in the trash can.
Apparently, no.
Oh, yeah.
You just said you haven't even seen any of those movies.
I've seen Weekend, I think, which is like early 70s, and that was complete trash.
Oh. The film was largely improvised on the spot, with Godard writing dialogue just in a notebook and telling it to the actors right there on the spot as they were about to shoot. It was shot entirely handheld and used minimal lights. So what are your initial thoughts?
So I first saw Breathless probably in high school, and over the years I've seen it a number of times. I saw it in film school, and I've always loved it. And I think the thing about Breathless that's so cool is that it still feels fresh and vibrant. Like the fact that it kind of, not invented the jump cut, but made the jump cut like popular mm-hmm. and like this sort of breezy, jazzy style. Mm-hmm. This is ground zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally appreciate that. And I think it's a good film. But I'm going to say this. I hadn't seen this in five or six years before watching it this week. I feel like I've aged out of Breathless a little Aww. Bit. I still think it's a good movie. And obviously it's an important movie. And it's technically like well put together. And I appreciate its innovation. But I don't give a fuck about either of them, honestly. And I think ultimately it feels kind of empty. And I know that's kind of the point. And I don't know why we always need to compare people, but Truffaut is definitely more my guy from the French New Wave. And I think Truffaut, looking at his first film, which was made a year before this, 400 Blows, is an infinitely better film. While it's not as like innovative, it's much more soulful.
It's so different, though. I don't think you can compare them.
I mean, you could, because it's each of their first films, and they came up together, and
but
they
like
were contemporaries.
You said, it is the point that they're empty.
I know, but I don't have time for that now. you know what I mean? And I'm not trashing Breathless. I think it's still a good film. I think people should still watch it. People should still study it. But from my money, where I am in my life, it's too hollow for me. Okay. And it's not hollow in like the Antonioni way, which is like this beautiful sort of like decadence gone awry. It's
because
just
in
like,
Antonioni, they are sad about their
yes,
emptiness.
Yes, exactly. Where this is like, they're romanticized. Like he's glamorized and he's a cop murderer. And it's like, neither of them have anything to say because they're both young or whatever. But like, it's just him trying to get laid the whole movie. And then it's her just kind of manic pixie dream girl.
Oh my God. So that was my first thought.
But like, again, I know this is 1960 and that was not a trope then. So I'm like giving it a pass, but it's just, it's kind of nothing. And I appreciate the style and I appreciate the way it's put together. I'm not a big Godard fan. And I do like his film Vive Sa Vie much more than this because there is a heart to that. There's an emotional center that this movie absolutely does not have. And I'll just say, like, it's just not really interesting from like an emotional standpoint or a character standpoint.
I totally get that.
And I think, too, like the end with him being shot and dying and then him making the faces and like, and then she does the lip thing back to him. Give me a fucking break.
Why? Why?
You know, honestly, this movie would have won me over a little bit more if at the end he died and it was like this really unglamorous death where he just kind of like flops onto the ground and like he's dead instead of like this making one last face. And like, I don't know. That's like the last nail in the coffin for me. Again, I still like the movie. I'm not trashing the movie. I'll just say it. Yeah, I don't think it doesn't really have anything for me anymore. And I don't see myself in the future being drawn to like, oh, let's watch Breathless. Like, this could be my last viewing for a while.
Wow.
Anyway, let's hear about you.
Wow.
You disown me? Do you want to get out of the podcast now? Like, all right, this is the last episode of Seen and Heard.
Okay, here are my thoughts. I'm going to talk about everything you just talked about,
okay,
but throughout the episode.
All right.
But my initial thoughts is when I was watching these new wave movies, I watched them in order. Like, I did, like, 400 Blows, Hiroshima Mon Amour. I did those first. And I deeply love those movies. But the second I watched Breathless, I was like, this is what everyone is talking about. This is new wave. Like, it overwhelmed me. Mm-hmm. I was like, yes, now I get it. Finally, like, this is it. So, that's... that was my feeling when I first watched it. And there's something so definitive and iconic is really hard to talk about for me,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to try.
Good.
The best way I can describe how this movie makes me feel, it's such a cliche, but the best way to describe it is I just feel so alive when I watch it. You can't deny how electrifying it is.
No, I can't.
And I just feel like free and easy, and I'm in awe of Paris, and I'm happy. This movie has never been sad to me. I don't think it will ever be sad to me, and I don't think that's the point. I'm just in a happy place when I watch it. You know what it was an initial thought for me this time around? Actually, no. Let me rewind. When I first saw it, I was in awe of the bedroom scene, that a crime movie can have a 25-minute scene of just like lovers hanging out, not really talking about anything, not really doing anything.
Not talking about anything.
I mean,
literally.
You have to be there. It's one of these movies I feel like, I don't know, it'll stick to me forever because it really was this revolutionary thing for me, not mm-hmm. and me who was born in 1995.
Yeah.
who was born. Another thing I thought of this time around is because a lot of it is improvised and then there was no synced sound, they didn't record any sound on set. How did they go back and dub themselves when it was just improvised? Like, how did they remember exactly what they were saying?
I don't know for sure, but maybe someone was recording on a tape recorder or something so they could just remember what they said.
Anyway, that thought popped into my head.
I actually didn't know it.
That there was no sync sound?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
Like I said, something so iconic, it's going to be kind of hard to talk about because there's got to be like a million essays, books, podcasts about this movie.
Where does this fall for you on your personal list?
I love it.
Yeah. It's high up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm also 10 years younger than you.
Right. 10.
Or 9?
Yeah. 7. 7. 7. I was born in 88.
I don't really know where we can start except for, I mean, let's talk about movies. Let's talk about how this is a movie. All new wave movies are movies by movie lovers. They're chock full of references.
The Cahiers du Cinéma is a group of critics and film lovers. And most of the new wave directors came out of that. So they were all critics first and film lovers. Just a little historical background if you didn't know. And also a lot of them were a big fan of like American sort of pulpy genre crime movies that were overlooked in America at the time, like Hitchcock, who was kind of dismissed as like, oh, he's just kind of over there making schlock for the masses. Mm-hmm. And the Cahiers du Cinéma was like, oh, no, actually, those are like great, great films.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this is Godard's version of a B noir movie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like all his movies from this era are kind of.
Oh, sure. Like A Band Apart.
They're his version of a certain kind of movie, and this is his noir thriller.
A lot of them are kind of crime oriented.
Yeah,
kind of pulpy. Yeah,
yeah.
Even Vive sa vie.
There's Une femme et une femme, which is like his musical, which is fun.
I've seen that.
It's. I think you'll like it. Actually,
I would watch that. Yeah, I'll watch any musical.
I think you'll like it. But yeah, so the movie starts out. It is dedicated to Monogram Pictures. Do you know what Monogram Pictures is?
No.
It's a film studio. It was a film studio that made cheap B movies.
In the US, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So he dedicated this entire movie to them. I feel like he's like the pre-Quentin Tarantino. Come on.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's obvious with Tarantino taking the band apart thing as his production company.
Right?
You can see it a lot in his early films. This huge Godard influence. Absolutely. And it's sort of like crime movies where people are just not really talking about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But in, like in 400 Blows and in this and in a, like all these new wave movies, these characters go to the movies and it's so important, like to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so great to see.
Yeah. And there's like needle drops. Like there's one or two in this movie, you know, and Godard famously sort of has his, in a Band Apart, like the famous dancing scene. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
So this movie's obviously full of references.
Yeah.
Did you know that his alias, Laszlo Kovacs, is the name of the character that Jean-Paul Belmondo plays in Chabrol's 1959 movie, Web of Passion?
Have not seen it.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. Famous cinematographer, Laszlo Kovacs.
Yes, but it's just a coincidence because Laszlo Kovacs was like a new Hollywood cinematographer. He was not prominent when Breathless was made. Which is so ironic.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
I always thought it was like a reference.
No. I even looked it up. His first movie wasn't until, like his first movie where he was the DP, I don't think was until 60 something.
Oh, okay. Well, this is 60, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the filmmaker, Jean-Pierre Melville, plays the author that mm-hmm. Patricia interviews.
Yeah. Have you seen any of his stuff?
I haven't. I want to... The Samurai is the big one, right?
It's the big one. And I'll tell you, I think that's the only one I've seen. I feel really bad. Like between us, we've only seen one Melville.
That's okay.
And no Chabrol. But
I know.
I didn't really like Le Samurai.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm excited to see it.
Yeah.
I also caught this time around that young girl that stops him in the street and asks if he cares about youth, she's holding a Cahiers du Cinéma issue.
Oh,
did you see?
No, I didn't notice.
I just love it. I don't know. I love these Easter eggs. I think it's really fun.
It's so meta.
Yeah, so meta. Obviously, he's obsessed with Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
The Western they go to see is a movie called Westbound.
Oh, okay.
And then the movie that Patricia is walking through when she's avoiding the cops is a Preminger movie. It is called Whirlpool.
Mm.
And he's talked about how much Otto Preminger has had inspired this movie. Yeah, a movie called Pushover where it's Kim Novak and it's one of her early roles. And she is just a pushover who makes the guy, who is the guy from, God, what's his name? Fred
McMurray?
Yeah, Fred McMurray.
From Double Indemnity.
Yeah. And then so there's another Preminger movie. It's called Bonjour Tristesse. And Gene Seberg was in it. And that was the inspiration for Patricia. Like, Godard saw that movie and he's like, yes, she's going to be Patricia. There's going to be this character. So she's kind of playing like herself a little bit, which is lovely. And I'm going to get into this kind of realism in the movie and the documentary aspect of it. But yeah. Oh, and then remember when I said that Gene Seberg played Joan of Arc in the Preminger St. Joan?
Yeah.
So that had come out before this and it flopped. But the Cahiers du Cinéma people loved her. Like, she became their, like, ingenue because of that movie and also Bonjour Tristesse, which is...
Wow.
Delightful.
It is delightful. I'll say this just in terms of, like... Okay, this is just me personally.
Yes.
So, this came out in 1960. Obviously, the film world was never the same after Breathless. There's no denying that. But for my money, what perfected the Breathless model... is Arthur Penn's film from 1967, a little movie, maybe you've heard of it, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, I like this more.
See, but this is that has the same feel to it, the same sort of loose, free, jazzy editing and jump cuts and stuff, but that film has real violence in it. And it takes a really unglamorous approach. The end when they're gunned down with like a million bullets. See, that's what I wanted from this. And instead he makes a couple cute faces, a little cute little lip thing.
But Greg, come on. This is him. This is him subverting the genre.
I know. But for me, that took it where it needed to go, Arthur Penn's film.
I will take a subversion of the genre where there's more talking and there's more romance. That's just me personally.
See, for me, even as a kid, I saw Bonnie and Clyde as a kid, and I remember the heat between Warren Beatty.
There's no heat.
What?
He can't get it up.
Well, yeah, I know, but that's like part of it, and it's like very like
not part of it. It kills it for me a little bit.
And Faye Dunaway, I just feel like there's this that's much more kind of like, I don't know, fiery than the romance in this.
Nah.
Plus, they're both complicit in Bonnie and Clyde, obviously, whereas it's just him in this. I think the most
Okay, no. We're going to talk about this. I don't know how to gather my thoughts right now. I feel like I'm being attacked.
Yeah. I will say the most interesting moment of Breathless is when she turns him in, when she calls the cops, and then she goes back and tells him she just called the cops. I think that's the most interesting part of the film, because that's like the one glimpse we get into something a little bit deeper.
Okay, yes.
So otherwise, it's kind of glamorizing everything. It's kind of glamorizing this like lifestyle. Like,
I don't
he's on
think
the run.
So.
He's cool. He's doing this lip thing. He's jazzy. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. And he obviously it's Jean-Paul Belmondo. Like, he looks amazing. Like, he's super suave. Like, I don't know. And Warren Beatty is that for American audiences, but he gets his ass gunned down at the end of Bonnie and Clyde, riddled with a million bullets in the most unglamorous way possible. And I feel like that's the difference between the two movies. In Bonnie and Clyde, there are people along the way who get killed. Again, I know it's a different story. They're bank robbers in Bonnie and Clyde. But I think you can draw a straight line between the two films in terms of like Bonnie and Clyde being directly influenced by Breathless. And I think in Bonnie and Clyde, like innocent people get killed along the way. And it's like a shitty reality of that kind of life of like, oh, this poor kid just died, or like, oh, his brother just died. Like,
yeah,
these people getting shot in the face who get in the way of like a robbery.
Yeah.
Whereas Breathless is, it's just him
but
who gets shot.
Exactly.
He killed a cop. He killed a cop.
I think about that a lot, actually. However, I think that you need to see the movie as, I don't think you should take it that seriously.
Well, but I get what you're saying, but how could you not?
I cannot.
For you, it's a breezier kind of, but he kills a cop in the movie. I feel like a kid, when you have your central character kill.
He starts, the first line in this movie is, well, I'm an asshole. He says that.
I know, but how could you, a protagonist that does that, how could that then be like a light movie or something you're not supposed to be take very seriously? So that's like a pretty heinous crime.
It's a heinous crime. Not saying it's not.
Yeah.
But I think that's the beauty of it, is the way that it works and the way that it turns a story that should be heavy into a breeze.
I think
he still gets
that's
his,
my problem with it.
He gets his
comeuppance.
Yes.
The problem is it's in this like really romantic, cutesy way.
I don't think it's romantic.
There's no
and
blood.
Cutesy.
There's like a little blood on his back for like a second. Then he's
this
like,
this is a rom-com.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's what I love about it.
I feel like Bonnie and Clyde, the romance is much more passionate. Like, the scenes of Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, like, rolling around in bed and Bonnie and Clyde are, like, very steamy. Whereas, like, this is, like, I don't know. It's just, like, him talking himself into getting in her bed.
You think that it's surface, like, it's kind of a surface movie, but I don't think so at all. I mean, like I said, there's so many ways to read into the movie. But my favorite, one of my favorite readings is this influence of American media on the characters, not only the main character, but Godard himself, the whole new wave. And that's its style and substance so mixed together that it is, the whole thing is about the influence of American media. Eisenhower comes. Gene Seberg is obviously American. He has his downfall by an American woman, but in reality, his downfall is because of his obsession with American movies.
Sure. But that's all
because he thinks he's a crook. He kills someone.
I know, but that's all from like a bigger picture. That's like it's like symbolically, but like in terms of the film itself, like looking at the actual characters, I just feel like.
Okay, here's what I'm going to say. Yes. To continue that thought that I just said. That is the character. Those are the characters.
I know.
Even she I is. Know. It's about not just I don't think it's about just American media and its influence. I think it's about art, the influence of art, like Patricia, in Patricia's case, she's building her expectations of love and herself. She doesn't know who she is. She's building it based off of the books she reads. Like, she reads Faulkner. Mm-hmm. She buys that poster. She goes, do I look like her? The Renoir poster, the music she listens to. She compares them to Romeo and Juliet. Like, that is the movie. Mm-hmm. But, and this is, and actually a critic called Dudley Andrew, he points out in this essay how ironic it is and how great it is how actually the American, she is more interested in actual art, where the Frenchman is interested in movies. Right. Which is such a nice touch.
Yeah. No, it is nice. Again, I let's like rewind. This movie.
Let's rewind. Let's rewind a little bit. Yeah. I want to talk to you now about the documentary style of the movie. Because I said style and substance are so intertwined. They're both so iconoclastic. Like, they're mm-hmm. literally just going against all our expectations. Mm-hmm. It's the textbook version of a new wave movie, essentially. But one of the things I love about this and all the new wave movies is just this documentary style. They had this free reign over Paris. They didn't have to get any releases from anyone. You can see people when they're shooting on the street. You can see people looking at them saying, what's going on here? Like, mm-hmm. did you notice? And yeah. then at one point, this soldier comes up to them and asks for a light. That guy was just a random guy.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
He's got to be. No, he's got to be. I don't know for sure.
You would think he would see the camera right there. But yeah, it could be.
I totally think that he's a random guy. But it's this free reign over Paris. And how can you resist Paris in the 60s?
No, Paris in the 60s is a beautiful thing. But you can get that from other films too. And I do think, look, I love the jazzy feel of this movie.
The street lamps coming on.
I know, I love that.
Come
on. That's very close to my favorite sight.
The shot, even the shots when he first... The introduction of Patricia is one, probably my favorite scene. She's just...
Is that your favorite scene?
Maybe. You're selling just the papers? Seeing her from the back. She's yeah. selling papers. All these people are walking by. All these cars are walking by. Not rehearsed, not planned. Just whatever is going to happen, happens. And it's so freeing and inspiring. And you're seeing yeah. her from behind. You don't really know much about this girl. And that's one of my favorite aspects of the movie. Now right. I'm just rambling. Is that...
No, please.
You start with seeing her from behind, and it ends with she turns her back. Right. And you never really know her, and we'll get deeper into that. But anyway, yeah. that the street lamps, walking and selling papers, what else? The aerial shot of her running and giving him a kiss goodbye. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. I don't know.
I think he's just like such a scuzzball. Like,
so...
He spends the whole film just trying to talk his way into her pants.
And it's true, like, but she also is a liberated woman.
And he's like throwing a fit like a little kid about it. Like, oh, why won't you sleep with me? Like, oh, and it's like, get up, get over. I don't know. He's just...
Let me read you something else that Dudley Andrew wrote in that essay, because I really liked it. And I think this summarizes... And, you know, Godard has said in the past that... He saw Breathless as a documentary about Jean-Paul Belmondo and Jean Seberg.
Hmm.
And let me hear. Here's what Dudley Andrew said. Here's what Dudley Andrew said about this kind of documentary mindset that Godard had. Breathless absorbs the viewer not because it represents an engrossing story, but because of the way it plays out that story. Thus, Michel Poincaré fascinates us less than does Belmondo, the irrepressible young actor coming into such a role. And Jean Seberg, it's true.
I kind of call BS on that.
No, Jean Seberg, I'm continuing here, though a well-known ingenue, likewise plays at finding her character. Perhaps at finding herself, an American in Paris, as she adopts pose after pose for close-ups that come to make up 20% of the film.
Here's the thing, though.
But do you get what he's saying? It is. She is literally just like looking at herself, trying to find herself. It's these close-ups. We are more interested in Belmondo than we are in Michelle.
Isn't that a problem, though?
No!
I don't know. I think it kind of is.
I don't think so.
I think, too, that's a product of its time. Like, sure, you're at the time, you're seeing him come into his own as a star and stuff. But 60 years later, we've seen a million movies that he's in. Like, it doesn't matter that Breathless, he's like coming into his own. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like, that's not relevant to today. Not like you need to view everything under like a modern lens, because I don't believe that. I think a lot of things, you know, it's a balance, right? Like, mm-hmm, as critics and mm-hmm. film lovers, it's a balance of watching an older film. You view it through the lens of the time and through today. And it's kind of like a mixture of those two things. And but I think that that's totally, I don't agree with that at all. And I think saying the actor coming into the role is more interesting than the character itself is a cop out. Where it's like, you know, it's excusing a cop out. It's excusing a fault of the film, I think.
So I agree with that statement, but I also think that you can still, like, I've done full on, like, I've thought about these characters a lot, and I still think that there's something there to talk about.
Like, of course there's something to talk about. I just think, you, like you said, you don't get to know her.
Either. That's the point. Let's talk about her.
So
I think this movie is so much more interested in her and rooting for her than him. So he tells her that newspaper, that story, right, about the thief who tricks this girl into thinking that he's rich, but really he tells her it's stolen money. And then he goes, oh, but she stayed with him anyway. Wasn't that nice?
Yeah.
And that's him. Like, that's him. He wants her to be this leading lady who melts in his arms, but he doesn't realize she's a femme fatale.
Yeah, no, I get how it's playing with tropes and everything. I just wish that I wish the film itself was more substantial. Like, I think the film, Godard is so concerned with being cheeky and, like, referential and subverting things that he forgot to, like, make actual compelling characters and, like, a story at the center of the film. That's how I feel.
I don't think you're supposed to know her. She doesn't even know herself. And I think it all goes back to this idea of this, like, lost generation of youth who don't know who they are because all they've done is watch movies and read books and then they turn on themselves and they're like, who am I? She says it herself. I don't even know what I'm thinking about.
Right.
But I will say that author that she interviews, he's kind of creepy, but he's also kind of pro women.
He is.
It's a bold statement, but listen to what he says. He says, when someone asks him which is more moral, a man who walks out or an unfaithful woman, he goes, an unfaithful woman is more moral. Mm-hmm. And then he says something else about the American woman dominating the man, which is hilarious. Mm-hmm. So it has these, like, that's what I mean. I mean, it's more interested in her. It's kind of more about her coming of age and her discovering who she is and what she wants. She doesn't in the end. She's completely fucked up. And that's not to say that she's the hero of the movie because she's not. Mm-hmm. What she does is fucked up. Like,
yeah.
It's not supposed to be like she's this hero getting away from this man. Not at all. I don't see it that way. And even he asks her, he's like, why do you write? And she's like, to make money and not depend on a man. I think it's so on, like, more interested in her than him. And I think there's something to say about that.
I guess it's just because he dominates so much of the screen so often because he's so kind of like, not frantic.
He is frantic. Yeah. He has tics. He thinks he's a character. He thinks that he's Humphrey Bogart.
No, I know. And yeah, that's cool. That is cool. I just... Yeah, no.
I love the scene where she's standing in front. It's during the bedroom scene, and she stands in front of a picture of herself. And it's like there's these two versions of her. There's this poster on the wall, and there's her. But we still don't know her.
Yeah.
She's mysterious. She's a femme fatale.
Yeah.
She's mysterious, but also, to a point, it's not for nothing. It is about emptiness. It is about...
Right.
Being lost.
I know.
No, you don't.
but yeah, I know. No, this is one of those movies, again, it is a delight to watch, and it's a movie that always goes by quickly, and it's impossible not to get swept up in, like, the style of the movie and just the way it's put together. It's amazing. But, and I get what you're saying. Like, it is about these characters who... And especially him, like, he's nobody. He's someone that's based his whole life, like, on Bogart and being this cool sort of 40s detective. And I get all that. But it's just like they're more interesting on paper than they are in the film. I think watching a 90-minute film about a guy who thinks he's a movie character is more interesting in theory than it is in practice. Like, when you sit down and watch the movie, he just annoys me.
I actually love him.
Do you love him? He's a fuckboy.
He is a fuckboy. But there's just something about him.
With his bracelet cigarette.
It's the bracelet. No, honestly, the cigarettes are ridiculous. He never uses... I don't think he has a lighter in this movie. He just lights each cigarette from the last cigarette. Yeah. But it's supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be silly, like...
Yeah. It's playful. Yeah.
I love the line she says when she says, you were talking about yourself, I was talking about myself. I should have talked about you and you about me. It's her discovering. So, like, I feel like this whole movie is her trying to figure out if she loves him.
Right.
But it's fucked up what she does. She realizes she doesn't, and she does something horrible. I mean, not really horrible, but horrible by the traditional, like, betrayal moral standards.
Turning him in.
Yeah, it's but not, she and here's tells the him. Thing. Yeah, and here's the thing. I used to think of her turning him in as something brave, because he always calls her a coward the whole movie. Coward, coward, you're a coward, you're scared. She turns him in. I always thought of her, of it being a move of like, oh, look how brave she is, and look, she's kind of like him now. Like, she's kind of morally ambiguous. I always thought of it as that. But now that I'm thinking about it, I think it could go both ways. I think it could be saying something is like, she takes the easy way out. Mm-hmm. She calls so that they come, so that she has no choice but to leave him. So I don't know. I think it could go both ways. I think it, well, I don't know.
He wants to be caught too. He has the chance to get away. She tells him, and his buddy is like, hey, come on, get in the car. And he's like, no, I'm tired. Like, I want to be arrested.
Yeah.
That friend really gets him killed, because he like forces that gun on him.
Yeah.
If he hadn't forced that gun, he just would have been arrested.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would have finally been able to sleep. But
do you think she's really pregnant?
No.
I don't think so either.
No. I think it's just another cutesy, like, manic pixie device.
Well, I don't know, because doesn't her friend, when they have coffee, say something about, oh, I heard about this pregnant woman who something, and he said, I hope that doesn't happen to you. I don't remember exactly what it was about. I don't know. I don't think she is, though. But
I think she just wants to see how he'd react to that. And of course, he reacts poorly. He's like, and why weren't you more careful?
Exactly. Yeah. And I love that you're looking at her face when he's saying that, because she shoots him a look like, are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
I love when they're and now I'm just jumping. I love when they finally go under the sheets and they're going to have sex, and the radio says, now for some music while you work.
Yeah, yeah.
Mission Travailler sans musique va commencer. À vous travailler sans musique.
That was almost my favorite sound.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. Yeah. Same.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, I get what this movie's doing. I don't know. I don't think that they're.
I think you've become, what's the word I'm looking for? Jaded.
It's not that I'm jaded. It's just that, like, I'm well into my, I'm almost mid 30s now. And I feel like he's like 26 and she's like 20 or something. I just feel like this sort of like youthful, like, oh, like fluttering around is just like not that interesting to me anymore.
That's totally fair.
You know what I mean?
That's totally
fair. And again,
fair.
I can totally appreciate how well this film is made and what it's doing. I just think as a viewing experience now, it's just, I don't get a lot from it. And I think this is why Godard has always been one of my least favorite filmmakers of the new wave. It's just because that kind of seems to be a lot of his work. It's just, it all emphasizes style over substance, which again can be fine. There are some of my all-time favorite movies emphasize style over substance, but you know, it's,
I think that they're intertwined in this movie very closely.
See, I think, let's go back to Truffaut.
400 Blows is a completely different movie.
It is, but it isn't.
Yeah, it is.
It's also about a lost soul.
A little boy who's inherently innocent.
I know, but
and this is about not being innocent. I this know, is a movie with no heroes in it.
Can we just talk about how much better 400 Blows is?
I like both of them. I don't know if I can choose, honestly.
I just, yeah. Well, okay.
It comes from a place of being a Francophile.
right. Little bit. You are, yeah.
I can't help it. I watch this movie and I'm like, fuck. Like, why isn't that me?
You don't want to get yourself in this situation. But
I would, because I watch so many movies just like her. So like, if I was back then, let me do it. Let me like date this bad boy and then turn him in. Why not?
With a bracelet.
Yeah. But not a leather wrist cuff.
Yeah. True. There's a subtle difference, you know?
Yeah, no. There's a difference. She is liberated in this movie.
Sure, no.
And she wants to sleep with him. She thinks he's hot.
No, of course. I don't think he's being creepy. He's just kind of being pathetic and throwing fits.
I don't think he's being creepy either, but I showed this movie to my boyfriend like a few months ago, and he hated it, and he said it's just him being a creep the whole time. And I'm like, I didn't get that at all.
I think he's more just like, he's just like a little, he's a child, I think he's a child. I think it's like
he is.
I know, but it just kind of gets annoying. I don't know. I don't know. I just
let's talk about jump cuts.
Okay, let's do it.
I think that they work the best when they're funny. Because I genuinely, the first time I saw it, mm-hmm. they were so funny to me.
What?
Like, okay, when they're driving.
Oh, talking to the camera?
No. Oh, okay. First of all, when he's first driving and he's singing the Patricia song and it's cutting, it's like jumping up. Do you want me to play it for you?
Yeah.
The Patricia song?
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Pa, 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 Patricia, Patricia.
Funny to me. I don't know when something jumps like that. And then the big one for me, the really funny one, is when he's describing all the things he loves about her. And it's like, yeah. I love a girl who has a pretty wrist and a pretty neck. And it's just cutting. And it seems like he's going on and on and on forever.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
You don't think it's funny?
No, it's good.
And then when he goes, I forbid you to see that guy. And then it immediately cuts. Like, you know, it's just like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah. I think Breathless is timeless. Like I think it still feels fresh now. And I think people who even like are not into cinema can kind of watch it and be like, oh, this doesn't feel old and dated.
What about the fact that when he goes to that airline office to collect his money, it's all one shot?
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't cut.
Yeah. No, technically, it's great. I love it from a technical
standpoint. The close-up of the caresses.
Yeah.
I love it.
I think, again, I don't know why I always need to compare stuff to other stuff, but I love Nicholas Rogue, and I think that, you know, again, he started a few years after this, but I think he kind of took the jump cut and like really elevated it and turned it into like a storytelling thing. But yeah, no, I mean, this is obviously, this paved the way for so many things.
Yeah,
so many things.
Do you want to know what Andrew Saris said about
the jump cuts? Let's hear it.
He said the meaninglessness of the time intervals between moral decisions, like that's how he described the jump cuts.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Should we do sight and sound? Or do you have more stuff?
No, I don't. I don't. Let me just say this. I think that this is a movie of all, like, for all time, like you said.
Yeah.
It's a movie for all time.
It is.
If you
yeah.
love movies, I can never forget seeing it for the first time. I really can't. And it's, I don't think that's going to die for me even when I get older. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. When you're an old person like me.
I'm sorry, I feel like I've been roasting you this whole time.
No, it is timeless. It's timeless. I'm just saying, like, I still think it's a great film, but I just feel like it's not really for me anymore. Like, there's nothing that I can get from this movie, and like repeated watches over the, like, I'll see this again at some point, but I'm like, it might not be for like a long time.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be more curious to like watch the Godard I haven't seen yet than like come back to Breathless.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well,
you're like, I'm watching again tomorrow.
I could.
Yeah.
I really could.
I'm sure you could. I believe it.
Vive Sa Vie, though, I think Vive Sa Vie is my favorite Godard movie.
Same. Of the ones
I've
seen.
And it's not on the list.
That's scandalous. It might be on the top 250, though.
It must be.
But not on the 100, which is what we're doing.
But again, in Vive Sa Vie, she goes to the movies and she has that really beautiful moment where she watches Passion of Joan of Arc. And again, I love...
I mean,
when you know a filmmaker, I say this all the time, okay? There are two types of filmmakers. There's a person who, given the choice, if they had to choose between watching movies for the rest of their life and making movies, they would choose watching. And then there's the type of filmmaker who would choose making.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so clearly obvious to me that the ones that choose watching are just better. Right? Yeah. And that's what New Wave is.
Right.
It's all these people who were watching for a living and then decided to reinvent and do it themselves. And I just love it.
I love it too. There's no way to minimize what the French New Wave did.
Yeah.
Like, colossal.
But then don't you agree that this is the manifesto of the New Wave?
You know, honestly, I will agree with you in that Breathless is like the definitive New Wave film, just because it has all of the elements like that you mm-hmm. think it's breezy, mm-hmm. it's fun, the jump cuts, it's all there for mm-hmm. like the New Wave aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is. This is kind of the poster boy for the New Wave, more so than 400 Blows, even though I think that's a better film, much better film.
They're like tied, I feel like.
I don't think 400 Blows is as like kind of
standard
flashy as this.
It's true.
Truffaut's
that's what
a little
I said. Like I said, when I watched those two before, and then when I watched this one, I was like, okay, yes.
But Jules now and Jim, it. Truffaut's film is a little flashier and a little more kind of taking a page out of Godard. I know you don't love it. Do
unpopular
you?
Opinion. I don't like Jules and Jim that much. I don't like it that much. I obviously like it, but not that much.
See, Truffaut for me has the emotional component that I need.
Yeah. I could totally see it.
You talked about Vis-a-Vis. That's why that's of the Godard I've seen. That's my favorite because it is this intensely focused character study. And he cares about this character that Anna Karenina plays. And you get into her mind and you're with her. And it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Whereas this movie, it's two characters you never really get to know. Again, it's cute that he's like playing a movie character. Like I like it on the surface, but Vis-a-Vis, you're with a character.
Yes. That's why I like him more.
Yeah.
Don't hurt me. I like it more. And did you know that he offered Anna Karenina a role in Breathless, like a topless role? I don't know what she was going to play.
Topless.
Yeah. I don't know what, because he saw her in a Coke ad. Was it Coke or was it soap? I think it was soap. And she was in a bathtub and she was topless.
Oh.
But you couldn't see anything. They were like, it was covered. It was just an ad.
Mm-hmm.
And then he approached her and he said, oh, you know, I'm making this movie Breathless. Like, would you want to be topless in it or something? And she goes, no, like, I don't want to do that. And he's like, but you were topless in the ad. And she said, I wasn't actually topless, you idiot. Like, it was a picture. Like
a swimsuit underneath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, fun fact.
Kind of a creep.
Little bit.
Yeah. That's your boy.
He's not, though. If I had to choose a boy, who would it be from the new wave? I would just choose Agnes Varda.
Yeah, you can
maybe.
Choose Varda. Yeah.
She's my gal.
Yeah. See, she is way more interesting than Godard. Like, let's look at her seminal film very quickly, Cleo from 5 to 7. Come on. That's like, that blows Breathless out of the water. Because there's human stakes to it. She's waiting on this prognosis from the doctor. And again, it's this intensely focused character study. I mean, I'll take Cleo any day of the week. I'll take Jules and Jim.
Absolutely, I'll take love Cleo a lot. But there's something magical about Breathless.
That's fair. That's
like
fair.
Something magical that I don't know if I did a good job justifying and explaining myself.
I think you did. I think you did.
Okay. But I obviously I'm obsessed with Cleo.
Or like Renee, you mentioned Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Oh my God. Beautiful.
Yeah. So that's why Godard is like low on the ladder for me, because all those amazing movies exist and then there's just...
Maybe there's something to be said about the fact that I do see this movie as like a really good rom-com and I can watch it no matter what my mood is, you know? Mm-hmm. It is light to me, where all those other movies we just talked about are heavier.
Well, yeah. Sure.
I don't know.
No, that makes sense.
Anyway, yeah. Sight and Sound?
Sight and Sound. You go first.
Okay, it's really hard. I have two favorite sites. All the ones that I mentioned throughout the episode were tied. But if I had to narrow it down to two, probably. So one of my favorite sites is after they're about to leave her room and they're fully dressed, but they lay back down on the bed and they both have sunglasses on and it's just really romantic.
It's so cool.
It is so fucking cool. We haven't even talked about the music. Mm-hmm. Which is so beautiful. Do you like the music?
I love the music.
The music is by...
What if I said no?
I know. I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it yet.
Well, we haven't gotten the sound. No, my sound is actually...
His name is dialogue. Marshall Solal. He's a jazz musician.
Yeah, it's an amazing score.
It is. It really is. Yeah. And I forgot to mention how much I love...
Oh, go ahead. How much what?
How much I love Jean Seberg's French, because I can understand it,
right?
Because she doesn't speak like a French person. It's the same thing with in La Piscine, Jane Birkin.
Oh yeah,
because her French is like so bad, but I can understand it because it's bad.
See,
I mean,
me,
not bad, just like the pronunciation is not like a French person.
Yeah
So I love it, and I love that. I love the trope, not even trope, just the her whole gimmick of asking what words mean and how she doesn't understand. Yeah. Because then it comes back in the end, and we didn't even talk about the end and the kind of ambiguity about the subtitles. That, do you know about this?
No.
So the last line he says, c'est dégueulasse, or c'est vraiment dégueulasse, which is just...
Legolas, Lord of the Rings.
Yes. It just means it is really disgusting. Mm-hmm. But then the cop tells her, he said, you're disgusting. So there's this weird dichotomy. He's not really talking about, and I think it's on purpose. I think the cop poorly translated it like on purpose so that she doesn't really understand. I don't know. Have you ever thought about that?
No.
Yeah, you didn't know about this?
No, just because I never thought too much about Breathless.
Okay. Anyway, what's your favorite site?
Wait, did you have two? Or that was your one?
So that it was that one, and then the shot of them like walking from behind when he first sees her.
Oh, yeah, classic. Also,
it's so iconic. Good.
My favorite site is Bogart's face. So when he walks
Shut up. I'll kill you.
Why?
What?
Okay, so when he walks up to the theater and he looks at the behind glass and sees Bogart's face, and it's just a shot of Bogart's face, and then he's smoking cigarettes, and you see the cigarette smoke kind of like go past Bogart's face. I was like, that's the movie. That's the movie. And it is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I exploded. I was a little you mean did. Just then. Because I really thought you were going to say your favorite sight was just Bogart's face. And I was like.
You're like, how dare you? No, because that's the movie.
I suppose.
And then Bogart was dead by this point. He died like early to mid 50s. So yeah, he'd been dead for a few years by the time this was made.
What's your favorite sound?
Favorite sound. Okay, so it's not the music. I do like the score. But it is when they are staying at their friend's apartment, their friend's flat, who's like a photographer. And she says, I was just thinking. And then he says, what? And then she says, I'm not sure. And then he says, about? And then she says, I don't know. Otherwise, I'd be sure. Because it illustrates how this movie's really about nothing. And this conversation, that little, it just went in a circle and it went nowhere.
That's the point.
I know, but also.
Wait, where is it at? I want to hear.
Je pense à quelque chose.
Quoi?
J'hésite.
À quoi faire?
Je ne sais pas. Sans ça, je n'hésiterai pas.
She said it before. I don't know what I'm thinking about.
I know, but it's just like, it's like Godard didn't know what to write. So he's like, okay, well, they have to say something. How about they just don't know what they want to say?
Agree to disagree.
What about you? Favorite sound?
So, like I said, I love how she's constantly asking him to like translate stuff, like what things mean. He tells her to step on it, pop it.
You would.
And then she says this.
Qui est?
Accélère, Minouche.
Qu'est-ce que c'est, Minouche?
Nice.
Yeah, every time I think pop it, I think of Pirates of the Caribbean. Hello, pop it.
Oh, boy.
No.
Those movies kind of came after my time.
They were after your time.
Yeah.
They were very big for me growing up.
I saw the first two in theaters. Didn't see any of the other. Oh, no. I saw like the fourth one or something.
That was trash.
But I like was kind of mad when they came out just because like the ride is so good. And then they started putting shit from the movie in the ride. And I was this is trash.
And there were so many people who didn't realize that the ride was there before the movies.
I can't even talk about that right now. I'm gonna get too mad.
Hey, Disneyland. There we go. That's our date. That's our
weekly quota.
Yes, quota about Disneyland.
Yeah, it opened in 1967, guys. Jesus.
What does Pauline say?
All right.
Please Pauline. Be good.
So she calls Breathless the most important new wave film which has reached the U.S. is a frightening little chase comedy with no big speeches and no pretensions. She says, part of the stylistic peculiarity of the work, its art, is that while you're watching it, it's light and playful, off the cuff, even a little silly. It seems accidental that it embodies more of the modern world than other movies. What sneaks up on you in Breathless is that the engagingly coy young Hood with his loose, random grace, the impervious, passively butch American girl,
whoa,
are as shallow and empty as the shiny young faces you see in sports cars and in suburban supermarkets and in newspapers after unmotivated, pointless crimes. And you're left with the horrible suspicion that this is a new race, bred in chaos, accepting chaos as natural, and not caring one way or another about it or anything else.
It is, though. That's the 60s.
Yeah. And then, if you foolishly depend on the local reviewers to guide you, it's just like trashing other critics, You may have been put off Breathless. To begin with, where did they get the idea that the title refers to the film's fast editing? That's about like suggesting that the title Two-Way Stretch refers to the wide screen. She says how the title translates directly to out of breath, and it refers to the hero who keeps going until he's winded. And then she finishes by saying, she says, an updated version of the betraying blonde bitches who destroyed so many movie gangsters.
Yeah, you know, that's the second critic I've heard refer to her as a bitch, which is interesting.
Okay, so she says this. They depend on emotions, and she is innocent of them. She's talking about Jean Seberg. Mm-hmm. As she had observed earlier, when we look into each other's eyes, we get nowhere. Mm-hmm. An updated version of the betraying blonde bitches who destroyed so many movie gangsters. She is innocent even of guilt. As Jean Seberg plays her, and that's exquisitely, Patricia is the most terrifyingly simple muse goddess bitch of modern movies. Next to her, the scheming Stanwyck of Double Indemnity is as archaic as Theda Bara in A Fool There Was.
Oh my God, can you read that back, the bitch?
Which one?
Description?
So as Jean Seberg plays her, and that's exquisitely, Patricia is the most terrifyingly simple muse goddess bitch of modern movies.
I love that. Muse goddess bitch. I'm going to use that. That is hilarious.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it sounds like a rave.
I think she liked it too.
Sometimes it's hard to tell from Pauline because there's no like final word. Like you look at the last paragraph and it's not necessarily a summary.
And there's
it's
just, no like grade letter.
No,
there.
She doesn't grade or do stars or any of that shit. I'm thinking about on Letterboxd like stopping to do the stars.
I'm going to stop.
It's like art shouldn't be graded, but sometimes it's easiest just to like show people what this you thought without writing a whole thing.
Okay, but this is why I only rate things that I like. I never rate things that I don't like because what's the point? I like to be able to look at my highest rated and see like what I like the most. That's why I only do things I don't like. Only things that I like.
That's fair.
Oh my God, wait. I forgot already what she called her.
Muse goddess bitch. Yeah, that's good. Should we do Letterboxd?
Let's do it.
Here's a star and a half. It's a quote. I don't want to love you, Patricia. And then it's the review. I really wanted to love you, Breathless, but now I want to punch you in your self-indulgent, lung cancer-promoting, smug face. Why are you so narratively lost? Why are you so pointlessly erratic? Why are you so dislikable? Why do you stroke your lips every so often? Why don't you cough from all the cigarettes you smoke? Why do you think you're the coolest thing ever? Why does Tarantino like you? Please kindly get out of my life and never come back.
I saw this one. That was great. 3 stars. This film gave me lung cancer.
I mean, all old movies had smoking in them. And especially that's the genre thing.
Yeah.
That's the noir. That's the pulp.
5 stars. I love this one. Jean Seberg, New York Herald Tribune, me pouring a pot of black coffee down my throat with a baguette up my ass. Oh, I love movies.
I saw that one. Someone gave it 4 stars and said, as fun and iconic as it is a slog, I have a complicated relationship with Godard.
We saved like the same reviews.
Did we?
Yeah. 2 stars. Funny how this is called Breathless, since I was yawning the entire time.
Well, when you're yawning, you are actually out of breath.
Yeah.
4.5 stars. The quick cuts made this feel like a train ride through someone else's memories. Someone's whole life just flashing right before your eyes.
Aww.
That's what I think true cinema is. When a film isn't just a film, it's an experience.
That's exactly how I feel. And that's why I like that reading of the documentary kind of attitude toward it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
0.5 star. This person's not kidding because I went through their comments and they backed this up. So just prefacing that. One of the most tedious films I've ever seen. Some really cheesy romantic comedy with some of the most uninteresting and annoying leads. It has the worst editing I've ever seen in a film. Full of constant cuts in the same shot, which is really untasteful. And they back it up in the comments, so they're not joking.
That's funny. That's really funny.
Also, how I feel like everything from reality TV now to modern movies kind of incorporates this style.
Yeah.
So it's like, how could you...
Reels? I'm sorry, Instagram reels?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. People don't realize when they make their Instagram reels that they're doing it because of Breathless.
Yeah, it's true. Well, do you have any parting words on Breathless besides the greatest thing to ever grace our cinema screens?
I never said that. And I don't want to be this cliche of this like young woman who's obsessed with Breathless and New Wave.
No, you
I don't
want to be really that. Well. You backed it up really well.
I just said I don't want to be that, but I'm wearing stripes
you
today.
You are. You look very French. Very 60s and French.
Yay. Thank you.
You just need the baguette.
Guilty. What can I say? I don't know. A baguette up my ass.
Yeah, apparently. Imagine that during the whole movie, a baguette up your ass.
I don't know if I have any parting words. All I can say is, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
This episode or the movie?
The movie.
I mean, oh, you're
not
talking
you.
To people.
I'm talking
oh.
to people. I know you didn't. You old grump.
No. Yeah, I guess that is a little grumpy. I guess I was grumpy this episode, but I'm just trying to be real.
Give me your parting thoughts. That's fine.
No, just like, look, I want to reinstate too. I think this is a great movie and a seminal movie, and it's just that the subject matter doesn't interest me anymore. I just feel like I've aged out of Breathless, and I'll take
totally fair
a sort of a sad story about aging people.
You like Citizen Kane more. In terms of debut features that were extremely revolutionary,
oh
like
God.
Citizen Kane Moore?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. Mm. Yes, I think so. Because Citizen Kane... In some ways, this movie's more interesting than Citizen Kane. Because Citizen Kane is just your kind of like classic rise and fall. I don't know. I think I do like Citizen Kane more. I think just because it's... That sounds such a boring answer for me to say.
It's okay.
I think Citizen Kane is just it's a richer movie.
Okay.
And I think it's like, I think you could really study Citizen Kane, whereas like with Breathless, kind of what you see is what you get, which again is not a bad thing. And some of my favorite movies are that way.
So all of those film references, that took like, I watched a video about how Breathless itself was Godard's way of like writing criticism. And he's like, I make movies as criticisms. Mm. So I don't think it's what you see is what you get.
It's not, I'm oversimplifying it, but I just think Citizen Kane is maybe a rich, not that Citizen Kane really subverts
emotionally
anything.
Emotionally richer.
And again, there's a 20-year gap between these movies. Kane came out 20 years before. In fact, without Citizen Kane, there might not be a Breathless. But... for my money. And again, I'm not like the world's biggest Citizen Kane fan. Like I think it's great. Yeah. I'd say Citizen Kane.
Okay.
And you'd say Breathless, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair. But yeah.
Well, that was Breathless and I'm out of breath.
Yeah. Me too.
Because of how much I yelled at you.
You really did. You really sold this one though. Like you did.
Thank you.
And very articulate about why you love it and why it means so much to you.
Thank you.
Clearly very passionate about it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, what are we watching next week?
Next week, we are doing Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch.
A Western.
This is our second Western, and it's going to be very different from The Searchers. I've seen this, but it's been like, it's probably been 10 years since I've seen it. Have you seen it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, this one's, it's kind of notorious for being the first like pretty, no, I was going to say the first pretty violent Western. I guess American Western, because before this, like the Italians were already doing it. But
when did it come out?
Came out in 1969, which such an interesting time for American film. I mean, that's what my all-time favorite movie, Midnight Cowboy, is from 69. So yeah, that's what we're doing next week.
Great.
It's going to be a wild, bloody Western.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
This has been fun.
Yep, this was a good one. Come back next week for The Wild Bunch. Until then, have a great week, everybody.
Signing off.
This has been an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club. Seen and Heard is Jacqueline Bastagian and Greg Kleinschmidt. Theme music by Andrew Cox. You can find us at seenandheardpod.com.